This is Bristol, and you are listening to a podcast from the Bristol Con Fringe reading series.
Well, hello everybody, and welcome to another Bristol Con Fringe. Before we get started, I've got a couple of quick announcements to make. Some of you may know that Crime Fest took place in Bristol over the weekend, and they had a flash fiction competition. What you might not know is that that flash fiction competition was won by our very own Kevin Henney. So, well impressed with Kevin there, and she'll be making a fuss of him at some point, about a week or so, because I've got him coming on the radio show to talk about flash fiction, so, as he does. But, in the meantime, somebody else is going to be on the radio this coming Wednesday. Somebody who happens to have a book launch at Forbidden Planet on Saturday. That would be you, Joe. Yes. So hopefully we will all see you at Park Street at Forbidden Planet on Saturday, and either listening in to Ujima Radio at 1 o'clock, Joe?
Yes. Yeah.
1 o'clock on Wednesday. Fingers crossed, I still need to hear back from our new guest. She is actually turning up, but I'm sure she will be. And then, if you can't catch it then, it will be available on Listen Again, and eventually I will get round to podcasting it. So, there will be things. Then, Joe.
There will also be beers and burgers and pizzas and things at the Brass Pig afterwards on Saturday if anyone's around.
Yes, a great deal of feasting and celebration and whatever to launch the little bloodthirsty book out into the world.
Is that book two?
Yes.
So that will be The Art of Forgetting, Book 2, Nomad, which is officially available as from Saturday. So, and now we can get on with the usual business of the evening. We have two fine readers for us tonight. Kevin Scott will be entertaining us in a little while, but before him we have our very own Justin Newland, who should be no stranger to you because he was here doing flash fiction last month, and of course because he's the kind person that saves me from embarrassment by asking a question from the audience every month. So I have no idea what Justin is going to be. I do know that he's working on a series of novels set in ancient Egypt, but you know, it could be just about anything, so let's find out.
Joe, well, thank you very much. It's true, I am working on a novel set in ancient Egypt, and I do ask lots of questions, so. Tonight I have prepared three short stories, which might overrun slightly, so bear with me. They have all a historical bent to them, and two of them have a supernatural element, so hopefully they will keep you entertained. The first is entitled The Caravan, and rolls like this. The dunes rolled across the desert like frozen ocean waves. The sky, ice blue, no clouds, no wind, just sand and scorching heat. Moses sheltered with his tribe in the dim shade of an overhanging rock. He watched the boy, Umar, tether the camels, not that they wander off into this furnace. As Umar walked towards them, he tore off his wrist amulet and flung it petulantly onto the golden sands. Moses stood up. Umar, pick it up. Put it back on. But it's so hot and it's flapping around on my wrist, Umar protested. Listen to me. The Sahara is a harsh mistress, Moses said in a tone midway between instruction and rebuke. When you throw your amulet onto her sands, you show her contempt. What is she to do with your leather? We leave the desert as we find her. Our lives are bound to her in every way. If we are kind to her, she will reveal her hidden waters. Disrespect her and she will withdraw her protection. Umar bowed his head. He should know better than question the authority of the tribe's shaman. Moses hadn't finished. The amulet is to ward off the Khazumar. Your father Uriah must have told you of the most dreaded of the desert spirits. Yes, he has, Moses. Umar slouched over to the amulet and attached it to his wrist. Later, as the sun's rim rested on the horizon, the caravan circled the oasis. The men erected the tents, the women prepared the evening meal while the children played, annoying the camels. Uriah glanced at his wife, Sena. Her high cheekbones and almost jet black piercing eyes. She was as beautiful and unforgiving as the desert. Time to eat, she cried, and they gathered beneath the soothing shadows of the palm tree to eat tagine and unleavened bread. Uriah had left his appetite under that crag of rock. He glanced towards the oasis. Long rays of evening light played on its surface. His vision clouded over. He imagined clouds of mist rising out of the water. A face appeared in them, his father. In disbelief, he rubbed his eyes. The face and mist disappeared. What's the matter? Zena asked. Nothing, he grumbled. She frowned and shook her head. He picked up his lute and plucked out a doleful tune his father had taught him. He recalled the angst he'd felt as a child when his father had lost his mind somewhere in the desert vastness and was subsequently put to death. At the time, he'd been too young to understand the strange use of a rolled-up carpet in his mercy killing. Uriah shrugged his shoulders. The memories evaporated and he returned to the lute, to which Moses listened intently, trying to catch the tunes in a story. Something was amiss with Uriah, and he knew what it was. The tribe was in danger of invasion by the dark presence of the Khazumar. The tribe needed protection, so he walked the camp boundary. In each compass point, lodged a pebble, creating an occult shield, a safe bubble. Outside it lay a sucking emptiness and overwhelming power of the desert. Inside lay safety, companionship, and a bulwark to loneliness. Returning to his tent, Moses made a mixture of bitter herbs, which he inserted into a small package, one for each member of the tribe. That night in his dreams, Uriah was menaced by a glowering presence, an unseen entity that reached to the roof of the sky and the far distant horizon. In the middle of the night, he sat bolt upright, covered in sweat from head to toe. His eyes bulged out of their sockets. In the morning, his hands were shaking, a nervous tick in his eye. When Zena handed him his break fast, he stared distractedly at the cup of mint tea, humming his father's tune. They packed the tents and prepared to leave. But before they did, Moses made sure they were all protected. He asked Zara to look at the women. They each pulled up their sleeves, revealing orange-red henna markings on their arms and religious verses inscribed on their silver bracelets. Then he lined up the men, checking they were all wearing their amulets. Over each of the foreheads he made a sigil, whispering, "Ward this man from the Khazumar." He recalled the words of his master during his shaman training. "The Khazumar is like the waters of the oasis, a clear mirror to those unfortunate enough to peer into her. She reflects back to a man his life's worth in stark, unremitting detail. She is true justice, just ice, stone cold in the midst of boiling heat." It was near to sunset when the caravan reached the oasis and Moses heard a horrible scream. Uriah leapt from his camel, his hands waving frantically. "Restrain him," Moses ordered. Four held his legs and arms as Uriah kicked and wailed and shouted, his mouth frothed with saliva like a rabid dog. "No man should have to see his true worth while he lives," Moses muttered, and placed the gag in Uriah's mouth. "Bring the carpet," he shouted. Before the final deed, he had to ensure the fleeing Khazumar had no refuge amongst them. Each member of the tribe took the bitter herbs he'd prepared the night before with a sip of water. They opened the carpet, royal blue with silver tassels, stark against the jaundiced sands. With reverence, they place Uriah on one of the corners and wrapped him in its folds over and over until the full length was rolled up. Moses led the tribe in prayer. The men knelt with their hands outstretched, foreheads touching the sand, trusting their God to protect them. That and the bit of herbs would keep the Kazuma at bay for the moment. As the weight of the carpet squeezed the last breath from Uriah's lungs, the Kazuma slipped away into the desolate wasteland of the Sahara. We grant this man release, Moses intoned, and in leaving no mark on his body, show him our utmost respect. The setting sun was pierced by the woman's mourning wails. As they confined him to the sand, Zaina closed her husband's eyes and placed his lute in his folded arms. Next to her, Umar hummed a doleful tune. Thank you. Okay, this next piece is more like an biographical meditation. I'll tell you its setting is the Tower of London. And from there, the story is entitled Shadows. Raleigh stood at the head of his walk and tautened his shoulders against the stiff breeze. The first step. This was ambivalent, both fraught and satisfying, a change from stasis to motion, planning to execution. As a child, that first unaided step had filled him with such joy. Beginnings were always exhilarating and full of adventure. A second step. Nearby, a ship heading downriver reminded him of his first voyage in a pinnacle. He was just 16. Still, he could taste the sea salt and hear the creak of the oak masts. Above all, he could feel the alluring freedom of the sea. From that point, he fell in love. Soon after, he fell in love again, this time with Alice. They'd coupled in an old hill fort, tongue on tongue. She took him fully, hands pressed on his naked buttocks. Now he thought about it. She'd seduced him, not the other way round, as he'd always imagined. The hussy, he smiled. He was glad he changed his will to her benefit. With the same steady pace, he walked on. Bored with study, he leapt at the opportunity to fight the noble Protestant cause. Vying against those Gallic papists, he smelt blood and gore in the thick of battle. With ardour, he believed a man had the right to pray in peace to his God. Down below, horses' hooves resounded on the cobbles, a yeoman on his rounds, his lantern swinging in the gathering gloom. 5 o'clock, he shouted. Another step. Then to court and Elizabeth, my shepherd of the ocean. What a glorious piece of work was she. Gone now, God rest her noble soul. As fierce like a lioness, as soft as a lamb, how she sported with him and girded him to ever greater exploits. A lady without equal. Step. And then Bess, old Bess, Cupid's arrow had smitten him right and proper. Her wit and charm had pierced his sullen defence, and he couldn't wait forever for the Virgin Queen. So Bess it was, his grace and downfall. Even now she waited for him in his quarters. A flash out of the corner of his eye. Dipping and diving, a bat? During his lifetime, he'd seen enough men masquerading as bats. That's how he'd ended up treading the cold stones of the bloody tower. He darted past again. No, not a bat, a swift. So late in the year, it was beyond its time. Like him. In his life, out of all his ventures he'd started, he hoped that Virginia would take seed. An empire, that was the vision. England across the world, the dream. Ex insula Angelorum, out of the land of angels. Reaching the end of the outward walk, he stood facing a wall of undressed stone. How odd, he thought, that even in a journey there was a pause. Without doubt, the turning point in his life had been the Queen's discovery of his hitherto secret marriage to Bess Throgmorton. He'd never seen a woman so full of jealous ire. Thou shalt have no other god but me. An autumn wind gusted through the bare branches of the plane trees. The ague played him hard, his body ached. Long shadows enshrouded Traitor's Gate. Pulling his gown about him, he turned to face the return journey. He reflected that the inward walk was subtly different to the outward, more than a change of perspective. A revolution not unlike the one Nicholas Copernicus had wrought upon the world, where nothing changed and everything changed. The restless pursuit of knowledge had greatly energized his life, yielding riches beyond imagination, and for this he gave thanks. With deliberate intent, he placed each step in the previous footfall, like a scout concealing his tracks. Through dint of repetition, he'd almost engrave each step of his walk in the stone, one for the outward, one for the inward. Those 14 tracks were his heritage. Thus he'd walked his life and times up and down, a modern Sisyphus, pushing the boulder of his life up an imaginary hill. 2/3 of the way back, the sound of heel on cobble echoed around the tower. Below him, yeomen hurried towards Traitor's Gate. To shouted orders, they muddled into a line of welcome. The drum beat hard, a stately bark trimmed in bunting pulled up out of the shadows by Traitor's Gate. Out stepped a man full of import and false dignity. The Lord Chief Justice himself. He can only be here for one reason. Finally, this day has come. The morrow will come and go, and I'll take my leave with it. And this is my last eve on God's earth. I've reflected on my life. I've looked back through the glass darkly into the history of the world. But to see the truth of oneself, well, she's a strumpet who'd make fools of us all. And what about good Bess amidst all these raging Stuarts? How will she endure without me? Well, she survived with me, so after I'm gone, she'll find it easier without me. She's a lady, that one, a strong one, and San Carew will be safe enough in her schmocks. Before dawn, I'll speak with the cleric. I'll unburden my soul to him and seek absolution for my sins. Pax vobiscum. I'll tell him how as a child I trod the red earth of Devon. I'll tell him how the Queen, how she loved and then loathed her royal knight and servant, her eyes. I'll tell him, it's too late now. He reached the end of his walk. Through an opening in the bloody tower, he could hear his servant cursing as he tried to light the fire in his quarters. Riley peered at the river through the veil of evening, cold and dark, the ebbing tide. Then imprisoned him so close to the sea, the place of his great success and his great failure. Even at this old age, he could feel it coursing in his veins. He sniffed the rain as it came towards him like a shroud. He was born near the sea and he'd die near the sea. He'd returned from El Dorado with his mind afraid. His son dead, but Bess had soon mended him. Even so, some unsightly scars remained, which only death could heal. One was his betrayal to the Spanish king, to the Spanish, by his own king. How could he sink so low? He forgave him truly. This was journey's end. I am ready for it, and have been for years. Thank you. This last piece is an extract from the novel, which is set initially in, shall we say, Atlantis. And this is the end of the first chapter, so mostly it does explain itself. The provisional title of the novel is Footprints of the Angels, and this chapter is entitled The Soul Bell. On the top of Spirit Mount, the rock crystal panes of the Crystal Cathedral glimmered in the mild green glow of the mid-morning sun. Up ahead, the crowd was singing the ancient songs. Irit and Ashitar squeezed their way to the front. Panion, the high priest, was already there, standing on a podium next to Elvenor the Augur, and Abans, another priest. Panion announced to the burgeoning crowd, "This is a glorious day for the city of Samulus and Atlantis and for the whole world. Look how we are already blessed with the healing balm of the soul bell, for here is Ashtar," he pointed to her, "miraculously recovered from her fever." "Praise the source," Elvenor cried. "Praise the source," everyone responded. A ripple of excitement swept across the crowd. The faces glowed with an inner light of hope. "Look at your neighbours," Panion invited them. "There are mothers and daughters, fathers and sons. Everyone is here. Remember this day, for it will yield rich stories for many a year to come. The soul bell has rung thrice, and that means it's rung everywhere across the world, stirring the souls of those in the Pyrenees, in Egypt, in Pearl Land, in the land of the clouds, even as far as the land of the Yellow River." The land of the Yellow River. It sounds so far away, Irith's mind flew like a sparrow as she imagined the people in those remote places gathering around their cathedral and their soul bell, their hearts bursting with aspiration. "I need 2 volunteers," Panion said, "2 maidens." "Choose Ashtar, she deserves to be one of them," someone called out from the crowd. "Yes, choose Ashtar, it's propitious. It's her day," the crowd trilled in agreement. "And a second," Panion asked. "Hear it, her friend," another called out. "Do you want to help?" Panion turned and asked them. "Of course," Irith replied. "Don't we, Ashtar?" Ashtar nodded, her face flushed with embarrassment. She's not used to being the centre of attention, but I'll grab this opportunity, Irith thought. "You make a perfect pair of dubs," Panion declared. "What would you have us do?" she said excitedly. Panion explained, "In a while, I'm not sure when, we'll all go back down the hill. When we pass the frangipani trees, look, over there, along the path near the stepwell, I want you to collect some flower petals from the ground and bring them with you in your knapsack. Can you do that?" "Their scent is simply glorious," Irith replied. "Good, well, don't forget," Panion said. Irith wanted to ask him what they were going to do with the flowers once they collected them, but he was talking to Elvenor. Solon, Ashtar's father, called out, "Tell us, this soul bell, isn't it to do with the surge?" "Yes, it's in the prophecy," Panion replied, rubbing his chin. "Remind us what it says," Solon asked. "Abans is the surge priest," Panion introduced a young man in a lime green robe. "He knows all about it." Abans said in a voice full of reverence, "This is the surge prophecy. Seek it not under stones, seek it not in the sky, for when the bell tones, the surge will be nigh." The crowd quietly absorbed the words as if every syllable contained nectar from the source. Solon broke the ensuing silence. "So has the surge arrived?" "Not yet. We have to wait for a sign," Abans replied. "What sign?" "When it comes, it'll be obvious," Abans said. Well, that was the bald truth of it, Irith thought. Like a whisper in the wind, everyone had felt the bell chimes resound in the caverns of their soul. They'd come to the cathedral. Now all they had to do was wait for a portent. "What about the surge?" Solon asked. Like everyone, Irith had heard about the surge on many occasions. But this was different. It was so imminent, she could taste it. It crammed the air with power and vitality. Abans puffed at his chest. "The surge is greater than myth and more than magic. It is real, it is high. It is the imminent future of the human race. Long ago, the Zeptepi brought the first surge, and from that walked to the original children of men. That was the first tentative step on a long journey for humanity. This is the next step up the stairway of creation. And as was prophesied, the 3 chimes of the soul bell herald the arrival of the second surge." "Who are these Zeptepi?" Solon called out. "Zeptepi means the first time," Abans warmed to the task. "In the surge prophecies, they're referred to as wondrous astral beings, mothers and fathers of all, as ethereal as starlight, as profound as the abyss. Some claim they are high angels, others warriors of the universe. Either way, they are authors of evolution." Irith had to pinch herself. "My friend healed, hauled back from the underworld, and on the same day the soul bell rings, foretelling the return of the legendary Zeptepi. bringers of the surge. After all this time, the second surge is to happen during my lifetime. This is the stuff of dreams. What will the surge do for us? Tomorrow, where will we be? Who will we be? What will we become? Solon wanted to know. Ah, these are mighty questions, Panin replied, on which the surge prophecy is strangely silent. So we don't know what will unfold, but let me ask you this. Does a chrysalis know it's going to become a butterfly? Well, no, it doesn't. And when humanity received the first surge, did they know they would end up like us? Well, no, they didn't. In the same way, we don't know on what paths evolution will guide us. Elvenor stepped forward. The augur will speak, and all went quiet. This second surge will awaken dormant abilities. It will transform us into people, unrecognizable to how we are today. This surge is the beginning of the great metamorphosis. Everyone cheered and threw their skull caps in the air. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Justin. It's now time for everybody to replenish their glasses, and we'll be back here in 5-10 minutes with Mr. Kevin Scott.
BristolCon Fringe is a monthly reading series produced by the BristolCon Foundation. Our thanks to the Shakespeare Tavern for providing us with a venue. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174.